This is WMUK. I'm Kara Lawrence. I have three guests today. One is composer Jean Knifick, one is violinist Renata Knifick, and another is Nora Lewis, the new professor of oboe at Western Michigan University and director of the Bullock Performance Institute. Tonight's concert features Renata Knifick in a solo violin recital. Renata says she's been looking forward to it for a long time.
There are so many great works written for solo violin. It's hard to pull off a program because of one instrument and one, you could say one dimension, because you don't have a chamber music or a piano with you. So it's important to, I was thinking a lot about the contrast of pieces that would create a program. Solo flight, I love playing chamber music. I do a lot of solo with piano recitals.
Right, which isn't
really
solo.
truly solo. So I'm looking forward to it. Quite challenging.
Is there something about playing the violin that also makes you think of flight?
Yes. There's something about violin. Of course, the oboe is even stronger. Something about violin, especially upper register, or lower too, but upper register, has this ability to soar. The sound soars so much, and reminds me a little bit, I don't know, of Messiaen's last movement, when he writes this ascending line for violin. Violin can soar and can ascend and descend. It has a really a lot for small range, relatively. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of colors, and I do think has soaring quality in the, and where people write for violin too.
Of course, the lark ascending is what
yes.
came to my
yes,
mind.
Yes, yes, that's true. Yes,
yeah,
yes,
yeah. So Nora Lewis, you're new to the faculty at Western, and into your lap fell the administration of this concert series. Maybe you can orient our listeners as you oriented yourself upon learning about it.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here and great to take on the Bullock Performance Institute. It's really an incredible series, and I'm learning more about it every day. But a few really unique factors is that it brings in top faculty as well as guest artists from around the world for different events, student collaborations, often with faculty, in a format of a Wednesday evening performance preceded by a pre-concert talk by Professor Robert White, also on our faculty as a trumpet professor. And so it's a really interactive environment that brings students at Western Michigan University who are enrolled in a music appreciation kind of class the opportunity to hear top-notch live performance, to get the context through the pre-concert talks, and to bring people in from the community as well in this very exciting, dynamic environment.
You know, one thing that we do as people very naturally is pretty much stick to the things we enjoy, we know we enjoy, and, you know, not venture outside of our little circle that often, maybe unconsciously. But the chance to be surprised and shocked at times, or just, it's usually something people don't hate. You know, in fact,
very true.
A lot of people actually like that feeling.
Yes.
And I think the series actually falls into the category of something that can, you know, take you a little outside your normal favorites.
Exactly. And it's been really great to look back at some past seasons and this upcoming season to see the kind of depth and variety, really innovative programming. And that's exactly right. It's an opportunity to bring something different to a fantastic audience.
Could you give us a sneak peek over the next couple of weeks for the Bullock series?
Sure. So beginning tonight is Renata Knifick's solo flight, which we'll be hearing more about today. And then next week, Jean Hébert will be performing with the Western Jazz Quartet. Jean Hébert is one of New York City's top bassists. Really exciting to have him in town.
Is he French? It sounds Hébert. Is it Herbert? Is how I see it written.
I honestly don't know. I haven't met him yet, and I do have the text, and there is the accent aigu over the E, so I am making an assumption on the sure. pronunciation.
I think that's the right pronunciation.
But he'll be collaborating with the Western Jazz Quartet next week, and he's performed with a lot of real top names like Andrew Hill, Fred Hirsch, Mary Halverson, really important figure in the downtown New York jazz scene. So it'll be exciting to have him on campus next week, both for the performance. Another great opportunity when we have guest artists come into town is that they usually do master classes for the students. I know that a number of classes are set up and sometimes work with the community as well. He'll be at the Union, I believe, Thursday night as well next week, which is another great opportunity for the Western community, as well as Kalamazoo. Other highlights for the fall are the Stockholm Chamber Brass, which will be coming September 28th. Our flute faculty Martha Council Vargas and pianist on the faculty at Western Jeremy Siskind mm-hmm. will be giving a concert as well. Fareed Hawk with Tom Knifick, the Sphinx Virtuosi Chamber Orchestra, Western Winds, which is a collaboration between faculty and graduate students under the direction of Scott Borma. And I believe that Scott Cowan will be having a piece premiered on that as well. And then Birds on a Wire and Contras Quartet with Sylvia Roederer and Brad Wong, clarinet and piano. So that's just the fall. It's almost every Wednesday throughout the season, and incredible variety of genres and styles. So really looking forward to it.
What's about the youngest age you could see in the audience for this series?
4 months.
Would you care to explain about that, Renata?
My grandson is coming. So this is, I know for fact, he most likely will be the youngest.
All right.
Anyway,
it seems like a great series to imagine yourself in a college setting if you're still in high school or even middle school.
Oh, yes.
You know,
absolutely.
We have following, you know, some of our high school students may come, and Andrew Kohler is always very spreads the word of those concerts. So it's a really nice combination, and we have really great following in a area in a community of the ballet performance. Yeah.
Well, let's focus in on tonight's program, which begins at 7 with a pre-concert talk. Mm-hmm. And did you say that was Dr. White who'd be providing?
That's correct.
Yes. Okay. Music begins at 7:30, and there's usually no intermission planned on these programs, right?
Yes. There's like, you know, breather in
yeah.
between. And there will be there's pre-concert talk, but also in between, I know I will be explaining and telling, maybe bringing people closer to the works that I'm just about to perform. So there will be little breathers for the audience and for me.
So Soaring Flight, any solo violin recital that doesn't contain at least a little Bach would be shocking to me.
Well, yes. I mean, Bach solo violin sonatas and partitas, it's the almost ultimate works for violinists, for the repertoire. They have it's Baroque, but it's the most improvisatory and beautiful works, because although Bach writes every note, it's a harmony, almost like playing somewhat of a jazz scene in that time. So he gave us lines, but really it's all based on harmony and the beautiful lines that he created to enhance the harmony. And quite honestly, it's probably one of most improvisatory works. But as the times go, it's more and more established how things should be done. Although it's kind of really exciting sometimes to hear different performances from more original sounding performances, say even on baroque violin, which mm-hmm. is very different, to performances, especially in a sort of era of Oistrakh's and you know, this sort of late sort of 20th century, where they played with the full sound and the beauty of violin as we have now. So it's I don't believe there's right or wrong, as long as it's convincing, although there are some purists as far as that's concerned. But I do believe it's the most incredibly timeless kind of writing. Yeah. You know? So that's why I had to do at least a little bit.
What sonata or partita are you choosing?
I'm choosing my absolutely favorite adagio from First Sonata, still open. Mm. Yes.
Do you, when you prepare Bach to play, do you also practice in or plan for just openness or this inventive spirit to come to you in the moment?
Yes, I do. There's I like the understanding of the harmony, how does that works, because that helps me shape it. Mm-hmm. There's a rhythm that's written for you, but there's always, you can look at things from different angles always. And the tension of music, how you direct the melodies, intention of harmony, it's a kind of interesting things where people go. When I prepare, I think a lot about it, away from violin, actually.
Yeah. Bach died in 1750, I believe.
Yes.
And then we have Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, all these composers, and we have no solo violin sonatas to show for it.
Not from great sonatas with piano, but and great concertos, but not that much from all the Beethoven's and Brahms's. Yeah.
So we get to the 20th century, and the current composers are actually looking back. Is that what they're thinking of when they go to write solo sonatas?
Depends. The two pieces that I'm going to do, you know, like Prokofiev and then Rosa, I would say is a little, they're both, it's a good question, because Prokofiev is really kind of very uncluttered, almost neoclassical work. And there's some more story. I mean, he was sort of, he was asked to write or commissioned by Soviet government to write something for violinists or many violinists to play as at school, let's say conservatory, be able to play. So this has been written a kind of interesting. It's a solo sonata, but also was written to be played by 20 violinists together.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. Maybe I should put my class to task. But usually it's played. So it's kind of unusual that way. But it's totally uncluttered sort of neoclassical piece, where in maybe those middle movement variations sort of shows more of Prokofiev's sort of that beautiful line writing, you know, in variations. Where Rosa, you know, is talking about cluttered, it's very intense, very much Hungarian driven. If you see Bartok or many composers that were fascinated with Hungarian music, which has its flavor, its rhythms. Sort of emphasis that sometimes comes in with the language, you know, of the accents, if they're in their own Hungarian language, and specifically in the villages that they were, you know, taking notes. I mean, Bartok really took a lot of notes with phonograph and stuff.
Right.
Rosa just wrote down a lot of things. But it's such a different source and idea that those two works present.
I have the Prokofiev you brought along queued up to the first movement. Is a good place to start?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. That's very much it's a near classic.
And this is kind of a classic recording you brought along from the first violinist to play?
Well, the work was written. This is kind of relatively unsettling and sad story about Prokofiev's end of his life. He did write this in 1947, but he never heard it performed. It was Ruggero Ricci that took it to, I think, Moscow or St. Petersburg, and performed, I think it was Moscow, performed in 1956. So it waited for very, very long time. So I brought his recordings. I mean, there are many great recordings and takes on the piece again, but I just thought it was good to hear from the guy that took it back to Russia. Right. So, yes.
My guest is Dr. Renata Knifik. Her performance begins tonight at 7:30. There's a pre-concert talk at 7 p.m. It's part of the Bullock Performance Series at Western Michigan University. You can find out more details at wmich.edu/music. That's from the Sonata for Solo Violin by Sergei Prokofiev. According to Professor Knifik here, it's a late work by this composer, a work that he never heard one of his great fellow musicians perform in concert ever.
I know.
Wow. And he knew some terrific players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Oistrakh premiered his concertos and recorded. He was commissioned by a lot of great people. Of course, Prokofiev's life is so complicated as far as, like, he lived in Europe. He lived in America. Because of the Depression here, he had to make his living more as a pianist. And I don't think he cared for it too much, running around and performing, which he was amazing pianist, of course. And he went back to Russia. And that was okay to begin with, but then things got harder and harder, especially if you take Stalin to consideration, things definitely got harder. And Stalin loved songs because he could follow the words. Everything else fell a little bit on a wayside, and there was a moment around that time after war that a lot of those great composers, Shostakovich and Prokofiev, were works banned from being performed. It's interesting because Prokofiev died same day as Stalin died, and you can imagine nobody even knew. He was completely forgotten. There would be, like, I don't know, 500 pages on Stalin and news, and maybe the little mention that Prokofiev passed. It was same day, 1953. And so it was very interesting how that ended his life, you know. But he's sure the contributions were remarkable. And such a different genres, everything from score writing for film, concertos, great piano sonata, violin sonata, just the great chamber music. I think he's appreciated now more than he was probably during his life, by far more. People love his music. I mean, everyone, how can you not love Romeo and Juliet?
I can't imagine him becoming less popular, only more
yes.
popular.
And I do think it's due to people just really appreciating what he was capable of then.
I really loved what we just heard, and I haven't listened to that sonata in years, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very, as I said, very simple in some ways, but still with a Prokofiev little touch.
Well, now I would like to talk to Jean. Jean Kniffick, you have visited a few times, but just to reintroduce you to folks again, catch us up on what you've been accomplishing as of late.
It's been a bit since I've been here, but really exciting thing that's happening most recently is I'm having a piece premiered by the Buffalo Philharmonic next week, September 21st. I believe is the date, and I'm super super excited for that. So that's a first orchestral work I've written, and it's not a shabby orchestra that's performing it. So I'm totally elated.
I think that is quite extraordinary. I think a lot of composers are out there very jealous of you right now. Jean, the last time you were here, maybe 2 years ago now, you brought in your trio with Evan Hyde and mm-hmm. Jeff Saunders.
Yep.
And we heard some of your original pieces and your arrangements, which borrowed from great classical composers.
Yeah.
So you were kind of on this path already, not necessarily straight jazz, but through composed classical pieces.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, having my mom come from more of a classical side and my dad coming from more of a jazz side, I grew up with both musics and have been really passionate about both. For classical, more ended up being more composing than maybe performing, but so I never feel super comfortable in one or the other, but rather like to join forces.
Is that what the orchestral piece, what is it called, by the way?
So it's called Relapse, and it was commissioned in conjunction with the American Composers Orchestra. They have an intensive every couple years that gets jazz composers, I'm throwing up air quotes right now, to connected with different orchestras in readings and performances, called the Jazz Composers Orchestra Intensive. So I attended that in 2015, last year, and a handful of us that attended were picked to have readings and premieres by Naples Philharmonic, American Composers Orchestra, and Buffalo Philharmonic.
Wow. So the orchestra's not expecting straight up classical. They know that you play in both worlds.
Yeah, so that's part of kind of the theme of the concert. So the piece I wrote is it's called Relapse, and it's kind of takes a little bit in connection to Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique.
Oh, that's a good joke.
I won't go on into it too much, but there's kind of this weird connection and that people make between, drug usage and some of the great iconic jazz musicians of, the middle 20th century. So, and I think potentially that, we lost a lot of great musicians from drug use, and a lot of lives were kind of haggard by it. But I think it's a little inflated and kind of romanticized, that, that aspect of it. So I was thinking about that and thought about, okay, romanticized drug use, Berlioz.
With the Symphony Fantastique.
Yeah.
So an opium dream is
exactly.
The whole story of that.
Yeah. Thanks for the background. Yeah, for sure. So what I did is kind of wrote like a short kind of tone poemy kind of thing. And the little story behind it is it's like a night in the artist's life being a jazz musician in this case, and starting, you actually hear the idée fixe, from the main theme of Berlioz, kind of started out like solo piano and kind of an Oscar Peterson kind of style. And then the orchestra kind of layers in, and it's a like a jazz tune. It's like a blues, but then you kind of fade using some kind of like more modern techniques and borrowing from like Ligeti and stuff, some like kind of sound massings that bring you out of the world and into kind of a haze and back in and stuff. So,
well, Gene, we're going to have to drive about 6 hours to see this. So maybe we should talk about
definitely.
The premiere of your other work tonight.
Yes, this is an exciting month for me. My mom is premiering tonight a work of mine entitled Warmth, and it's a piece for solo violin and loop pedal. Basically, the concept behind it is I wanted to, it's kind of like a gift, you know. It's I wanted to kind of shower my mom with like warmth and light and love on stage. So I wrote a piece that is very contrasting to the other material, in that there's a lot of kind of more atmospheric sounds and lush sounds that kind of take a while to be drawn out, and with the loop pedal get layered on top of each other. So you've got these kind of stacks of textures and melodies interacting with each other and right. Things like that.
I've seen people do this on stage. It looks like if they have, you know, their guitar or their instrument going, they quickly tap the loop pedal with their foot at the same time they start a pattern on their instrument.
Exactly.
And then they have to tap it off?
Yes. So it's you use the pedal to record a little sample of what you're playing. Mm-hmm. So my mom has a microphone attached to the violin for this piece, and it runs through the loop pedal and an amp, amplifier. And so you tap it to start, and you sample it, and then as soon as you're done playing it, you tap the pedal again, and then immediately that phrase gets repeated and repeated. And then you can start layering sounds over that to
Another set of phrases?
With another set of phrases. And they just have to fit in the length of that original sample for the pedal that I have. And I think it can hold up to like 11 or 16 samples on it at a time.
When I've seen this done in a maybe less than artistic way, the chord never changes.
Sure. So that was a challenge, to be able to use it in a way that is
harmonically moving.
Yeah, or at least stagnant in some certain way. So what I kind of came up with is there's kind of three sections of the piece where the first section, it opens up, and then we have our first bass sample. And instead of just kind of layering, okay, here's one thing, then we put another thing on it, put another thing on it, it's more, if you can imagine, kind of a staircase. So we have the first sample, we layer that down, and then we have a couple melodies over that, and then we'll slip in another little thing over it, and then we have those two, and then we're then continue to play and then slip in another thing. So little by little we're building, and there's still motion going on to bring us through those things, instead of kind of here's a thing, here's another thing, here's another thing.
The wall of,
And then figured out ways to like end that and then start a new thing. So instead of the whole piece being under one sample one kind of thing. It's broken up into like little 2-minute segments or something like that.
Well, now that sounds a little more challenging and exciting for me as a listener too.
Wow. Should be a little different.
Renata, you've done, you know, pieces that went outside the scope of traditional classical playing many times.
Yes.
Was this new though?
Very new, as far as like using pedal. Yeah. Yes, that, you know, your children always bring you to the newest things and challenge you.
And, you know, in orchestra, you're always told, do not tap your foot.
Do not tap your foot, right. The concentration, the having to do both, like this beautiful moments, and then be aware that, say, end of certain section, you're layering another note to tap in the right time to make sure that it suddenly matches or is the long enough, and that actually tap works, and learning how to end it and when to end it. It's a really kind of multi-dimensional thinking that happens. I had to really get used to sort of thinking that way.
Yeah, multitasking.
More like I'm playing the harmony, you know, and I'm two people, like one that layers certain things and then I'm this person that plays over. And, you know, the tapping sometimes doesn't work out, or you have to learn how to redo things sometimes if it didn't record. I mean, it's a life thing, you know. So, yeah, I spend, it started with me learning the notes, then tapping the floor, then tapping
the pedal
it's really very special to be able to. It really stretches your way of thinking, you know. You almost have to sometimes look if it's recording, you know. So I have to be able to pay attention to lots of things. So it's really challenging, but it layers such a sometimes beautiful sound. There's one harmonic section that I just layers a whole bunch of this mysterious almost sounds like that I play over. It's lots of fun. And I hope to tap well tonight. Tap on time.
My guest is violinist Renata Knifik, professor of violin at Western Michigan University, who performs completely solo tonight. Music begins at 7:30 p.m. It's about a 75-minute concert. There's a pre-concert talk at 7 p.m. I'm also here with composer Gene Knifik, who is Dr. Knifik's son and a rising composer in both jazz and classical fields, and Nora Lewis, who is joining us as the director of the Bullock Performance Institute. And tickets are available at the door tonight or through the Miller Auditorium box office, milleraudatorium.com, or look for more details at the School of Music website, wmich.edu/music/events, and you'll see the full lineup of the Bullock series there. We now have about 15 minutes left in the hour, and still the Roja, or you say Rosa. I've always thought it was Roja. I don't know how to say it. He's Hungarian. We've talked a little bit about him
already.
Yeah,
Rosa. Roja. I think it's Rosa, mm-hmm. because Zha would be potentially reverse of this, Sha, as S and Z, Rosha.
Yeah,
Rosa.
It's R-O.
So you pronounce both, but I will, if we had Hungarian person, I feel more comfortable. But totally born in Hungary, Budapest, and then was Austro-Hungarian area, so now Hungary, but those days, you know, the borders were very interesting. Incredible story. I would say the best description of him, his life and composition life, or as a it would be his biography that is named Double Life. Because if you think of him in America, or you can think of over 100 scores of biggest movies in Hollywood, Ben-Hur, Spellbound. I mean, it's just, he worked with Hitchcock. He worked with everyone that you may, you know, the top.
Yeah, he was one of...
One of the. There wouldn't be John Williams kind of story if it wasn't for Miklos Rosa, who started that sort of, relationship with directors and everything that went with it, you know. In his classical side, he was kind of like Bartok and Kodály, totally influenced and in love with his nation's vocabulary in music, you know. And he was born to relatively wealthy parents, and they would go to villages where they have their summer home. And whenever parents were not around, he would pick up his violin and jam with gypsies and others, you know. So he was totally invested in that sound. And he didn't record all this details of folk music. He, like Bartok, I think, took phonograph or whatever it was, that he really collected everything.
He made a system out of it.
Yes, made a system. Where Rosha just went with his little black book and copied tunes.
Yeah.
So I would say, and he's not performed as much. I think is it maybe the difficulty of his music, but he wrote incredible amount of great chamber music duos. I've performed a couple of years ago duo for two violins with my colleague from California, and his vocabulary will remind you definitely of Bartok. But influence also, because since this work was written 1986, so it's
very
quite
modern.
It's relatively modern. So he has some influences. I don't know. Tom thinks, my husband thinks he can hear blues, but you know, who knows? But there's another take on it, I would say. It's very full of dance, rhythm, power, but slow movement. It's very big piece. It's like, I don't know, I don't want to scare anyone. It's about 30 minutes. But slow movement is the most incredible set of variations, kind of based on a very, how do you say, like lonely melody, something very, I don't know, something that... I sort of think of melancholia a little bit in that. He almost departs entirely from that melody, but it goes from very aggressive couple of variations through the most beautiful soaring variations. Soaring for violin, how's that? Incredible work. His life and achievements. In fact, he wrote a lot of solo music. He did cello, he did clarinet, viola. He has concerto for viola, for violin. Especially in the end of his life, he was not doing well for some reason, stopped writing the huge scores. So there is appearance of a lot of solo works.
So well encapsulates the idea of the Bullock series. There's something unknown here, something to discover, something to maybe shock or take you into different places.
Yeah, I was really trying, as I said at the beginning, to create something of a contrast and show Valen maybe in a few different roles or... where violin can ex- be ex- ex- extended or very pure in Bach, although it's not as simple as all that.
Well, this is a very unexpected and interesting way to begin the series, and it begins with Renata Knifek tonight at 7:30. Final thoughts, Gene, on tonight's concert with your mom and as a soloist?
It's going to be really, really special. Just the work it takes to put in to make a concert like this of really solo violin works that are, you know, very intense and you know, kind of long and by these great composers, excluding myself. but it's in for a treat if you come tonight.
Renata?
I'm so grateful that I finally been able to do it, and something I wanted to do for a very, very long time. And it's really amazing that I have opportunity to indulge so much in my own. But it's special, and I'm going to have entire family with me, and that means a lot to me. Including all my children, John, Jean, and Christine, and my grandson, Sam. So I just love that fact, and, well, we'll see.
And Nora, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm just thrilled that Renata Knifek is presenting this recital this evening, a fantastic way to launch the 2016-2017 season of the Bullock Performance Institute. Should be a very, very special evening, and really looking forward to it.
All right. We'll see you all again back at WMUK at different points in the year, hopefully. And let's listen to a little bit of the Rosa to take us up to 11 o'clock. Here's music from the first movement.